Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 147, Nirvana and the Brain, April 11th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Have this ongoing brain chatter in the left hemisphere, in the language centers, that is designed to have communication, and it helps you retain information about the external world. And when, so I know where I work because my brain tells me where I work, and I know which car is mine because my brain tells me which car is mine. So it's always relating me to the information in the external world. And when that circuitry turned off, I found myself flushed in silence, and an unusual silence. But in the silence, there's so much. I'm no longer distracted by the details of the external world. And I was captivated by the magnificence of the present moment. And since I could no longer identify the boundaries of where I began and where I ended, I was no longer this confined little entity. Instead, I was at one with all the energy that was around me. And it was beautiful there. It was peaceful. It was quiet. It was enormous. It was that all-knowing space where you know absolutely everything and you don't know a single detail that has anything to do with the external world, and it doesn't matter because you have this sense of peacefulness and beauty and euphoria.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, describing her experience of a stroke in the left hemisphere of her brain. Jill Bolte Taylor, PhD, is a Harvard-trained and published neuroanatomist who teaches at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Bloomington, Indiana. She's the author of the extraordinary book, My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, which tells the story of a stroke which essentially knocked out her left hemisphere and enhanced the functioning of her right hemisphere. In this right hemisphere state, she seemed to experience something akin to enlightenment. Dr. Jill has dedicated her career to the advancement of postmortem research into the human brain and to the education of the public about the fragile yet resilient nature of this incredible organ. Because of the long-term shortage of brain tissue donated for research into severe mental illness, she travels throughout the country. By sharing her science and her unique personal journey, she communicates a message of hope, education, and celebration. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Well, I saw a video of your presentation at the TED conference, and it blew my mind. And for listeners, TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, which seems like an unlikely conglomeration, but they have some wonderful speakers, and I'm going to be sure to put a link to that session that you did at TED in our show notes. But let's start out by having you tell us about your life before you had your stroke. In your book, you talk about the left and right hemispheres of the brain and how they function. And this turned out to be important because you had a stroke on the left side of your brain. So before you tell us about your experience with a stroke, perhaps you could give us some background on the functioning of the left and right hemispheres. And also a bit about your background as a brain scientist, because that's very relevant as well.
Well, I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who has the brain disorder schizophrenia. And although he wasn't diagnosed until we were young adults, when I was a little girl, he was only 18 months older than I was, And it was apparent to me at a very early age that he was very different in the way he perceived the world and in the way he chose to behave. And because he was my sibling, he was my constant companion, as siblings are in a family unit. And I really grew up to see the world through his eyes. And it just did not resonate well with little Jill and who I was and what I thought was how I was supposed to be in the world. So because of my fascination with my brother and the awareness that we were very different, I dedicated my career to studying the brain and became fascinated with the brain, obviously very young, and was fascinated with body language and different ways of communicating with one another and how we can observe ourselves or engage in the drama in our lives. So I really had a kind of a shifted perspective of what is normal and what is not normal, but I didn't know who was normal. And I didn't know if it was him or if it was me until he was officially diagnosed as young adults.
Mm-hmm.
But I pursued education in physiological psychology and human biology for undergraduate, and then received a PhD with a focus for my research in neuroanatomy of the brain. And it was my intention to always study the postmortem investigation of the brain as it relates to schizophrenia. What are the biological differences between someone like my brother and someone like me?
Yes.
So that was my background leading up to the morning of the stroke. So I was performing research and teaching in the Harvard Medical School system at the time, and it was the relationship between the right and the left hemispheres is extremely significant in the world of brain research because each of the hemispheres perform unique functions. They're both always functioning, but there's usually certain cells that are dominating or inhibiting other cells. And that's unique for each one of us. And when you look at stroke survivors, for example, the first question I always ask anyone who calls me and says my loved one has had a stroke is, can they speak? Has it influenced their ability to speak words or to understand language? And if the answer is yes, then I can pretty much automatically assume that the stroke happened in the left hemisphere as opposed to the right hemisphere. And of course, the opposite side of the body becomes paralyzed when a stroke happens and the motor cells are influenced. So the two hemispheres complement one another. They're constantly always functioning, but they're not all the cells are not always constantly firing. Some are more dominant, some are inhibited by those dominating cells.
Yes, and you know, I guess it was in the 70s when we started to hear a lot about split brain research and so on, and there was kind of a popularized view of the functioning of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, but I suspect it was overly simplified.
It really was, and I think that what happened in, because I was born in 59, so all of that was pretty big when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it oversimplified it to the point of saying, okay, I'm a right hemisphere person.
Yes.
Or I'm a left hemisphere person. And as a result of that, we ended up with all kinds of personality tests that came out to identify which hemisphere are you. And I always had a certain amount of skepticism about that level of simplification because I had two hemispheres, and we all have two hemispheres. And I was very blessed that my father was extremely creative, extremely musical, extremely social, and anybody would have defined him as right hemisphere. While my mother was history and philosophy of science and mathematics, and you know, she had this incredible mind. She was a Radcliffe Harvard girl, and so my mother had this extremely well developed and beautiful left hemisphere, and I'm looking at me as their offspring saying, but I'm both. I have this right hemisphere mm-hmm. from my dad and this beautiful left hemisphere from my mother, and we all do. So it you know, when you pinhole a child into, oh, your child is very right hemisphered, and then that's all they develop, that's unfair to the child. And for me, the purpose of the video was to help people to actually, you know, bring new fuel, if you will, to the old argument, but to expand it beyond where we used to be with it. And to try to help people recognize, yes, I do have both of these hemispheres. They both have these beautiful gifts, and I don't have to be just one way. I have a choice moment by moment in how I do want to be in the world and how I do want to spend my time and how I do want to look at this specific situation.
Now, you, part of the reason that your story is so extraordinary is here you are working at Harvard as a brain scientist, and then you have a stroke. So it gives us an unprecedented view of, from the inside, of a person who has extensive training and knowledge about the functioning of the brain, and you're able to, as it were, witness this process from the inside. So take us through the morning of your stroke.
Well, on the morning of the stroke, I first woke up and had a major pounding, pulsating pain behind my left eye. And it was that kind of pain that you get when you bite into ice cream. It was that excruciating where you just scrunch the whole left half of your face in order to endure the pain.
Sure.
And then it would pulsate like that, so it would grab me and then it would release me. And it was very unusual for me to experience any kind of pain. And I was only 37 years old at the time, so I was physically fit. I generally have low blood pressure. My weight is excellent. I exercise daily. I had zero of the risk factors for stroke. So I'm not a girl who's thinking, I've got a bad headache, I'm having a stroke.
Yeah.
So, and it turns out that it was a hemorrhagic stroke, not an ischemic stroke. So with a hemorrhage of blood vessels, it was actually a congenital malformation in the blood vessels in my brain. It was an arteriovenous malformation, an AVM, where an artery is directly connected to a vein with no capillary bed, which buffers the pressure system in between that artery and vein. And it was essentially a bomb waiting to blow inside of my head. And when people have an AVM explode, usually it happens between the ages of 25 and 45. So I was right on time. I was 37 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I woke up and this blood vessel broke inside of my brain, and it started out as this pounding headache. And so I got up and I jumped onto my normal routine, which is a cardioglider, a full body exercise machine. And I was exercising on this machine, and I was looking at my hands, and my hands looked like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And it was as though my mind had shifted away from the normal perception of me and my normal reality where I'm on the machine having this experience to some esoteric space where I'm witnessing myself having this experience. And it was all very peculiar. So I then got off the machine and I was walking across my living room. And I don't want to run through the whole video for you. For me, there was the most noticeable factor was a slowing down of everything in my body. I just felt slow. And as I slowed down, my movements became very rigid and very deliberate. And I can actually hear conversations going on. It felt as though a conversations of the cells communicating with the cells. And then I lost perception of the boundaries, the physical boundaries of my body, where I begin and where I end, where I just saw myself as energy, radiating energy, and the atoms and molecules of the density of my form just blended with the energy radiating around me. So the portion of my brain that was going through this process, the unique factor of me having been a neuroanatomist, studying the brain, understanding how the brain organizes information, in watching the process by process deterioration of my mind and its ability to be able to communicate in the external world. But it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side that I realized that, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. Up to that point, I'm just trying to figure out what's wrong with me. Am I having a migraine? Am I having, well, what am I having? I don't know what I'm having. But the key for me was when my right arm went paralyzed, and then I realized, oh my gosh, it's a stroke, it's a stroke. And you know, I'm a neuroanatomist, so I'm curious, and it's like, whoa, this is so cool. you know, because it's like, wow, how many scientists do have this opportunity to explore their own process of degeneration? And, but I certainly had no idea that I was going to end up as far away from normal reality as I got on that morning.
Well, at some point, you describe a process in which you, first of all, you describe that the sort of left brain inner chatter, if you will, sort of quieted down to where you weren't able to form words and weren't having thoughts.
Right.
It, it sounded like there was a period during which you were in a kind of state of ecstasy when you felt the flowing energy and so on. How long did that period last, would you guess?
Actually, it lasted 6 weeks. it wasn't that the brain chatter became quiet, it's that it got shut off. You know, this experience has really given me a different perspective as a neuroanatomist about my brain and about how it organizes information. And I realize now that I am neurocircuitry. I am cells communicating with other cells with chemicals. And when we alter the chemical communications, we can alter which circuits are running more or running less. But ultimately, we are circuitry. And on that morning, I was actually having the circuitry being completely silent. It was just like a remote control pushing a mute button. It wasn't a little, oh, dazzle, dazzle, drag down, quieter, quieter. No, it was on or it was off. And when it was off, I was no longer attached, because I mean, when you think about it, you know, how is it that you know when you get up in the morning and you're brushing your teeth and you look into a mirror and you say, hi, David. Did you ever wonder how you know what your name is?
No.
Now you will. And you know your name because your brain chatter is telling you what your name is all the time. You always have this knowingness. Mm-hmm. And it might not be in language that you're listening to, but sometimes it is. You have this ongoing brain chatter in the left hemisphere, in the language centers, that is designed to have communication. And it helps you retain information about the external world. And so I know where I work because my brain tells me where I work. And I know which car is mine because my brain tells me which car is mine. So it's always relating me to the information in the external world. And when that circuitry turned off, I found myself flushed in silence and an unusual silence. But in the silence, there's so much. I'm no longer distracted by the details of the external world. And I was captivated by the magnificence of the present moment. And since I could no longer identify the boundaries of where I began and where I ended, I was no longer this confined little entity. Instead, I was at one with all the energy that was around me. And it was beautiful there. It was peaceful. It was quiet. It was enormous. It was that all-knowing space where you know absolutely everything and you don't know a single detail that has anything to do with the external world, and it doesn't matter because you have this sense of peacefulness and beauty and euphoria. And well, in the video, I define that as nirvana.
Yes, well, that's what got me so excited about wanting to interview you, because it sounds so much like the nirvana or satori experience that longtime meditators report.
Right.
And they talk about, you know, working at learning to turn down the chatter, to turn off the words, and you had that experience kind of forced upon you. What sense do you make? Had you been a meditator, by the way, before this experience?
I wasn't a formal meditator, as I think of what is meditation, but mm-hmm. I've always been a child of nature. So every day it was a priority for me to get exercise and movement, and I would usually walk at least an hour in nature, try to find a place where I could be alone, and that is a form of meditation. So for me, but you know, when you go out in nature and you start really being at one with the birds, and you're listening and you're paying attention and you're distracting your mind, the brain chatter, away from your daily routine of, oh, I've got this experiment I've got to deal with tomorrow and I've got to take care of this and take care of all those details. It's that willingness to shift to a different perception than the constant details of my life. And so in a way I was, and in a way I still am, but I'm not trained in meditation. I understand there are lots of different forms of meditation that do essentially the same objective, again, primarily to quiet that brain chatter so that you can hear the rest of life that's going on. And I know that there are different techniques, but I am not at all versed in the different kinds of techniques that different people use.
Okay. Well, the experience that you described just sounds like so much of, you know, what I've read from mindfulness meditation and Buddhism and Zen and so on. Did this experience change your sense of your relationship to the universe, to ultimate questions?
100% shift.
So
100%. Because for me, to sit inside of a silent mind, the brain chatter, those cells were flooded in a pool of blood, and they couldn't function. So I sat in absolute total silence for 2.5 weeks up till my surgery. And then it took another couple of weeks after my surgery before the blood clot, once the blood clot was removed, for the swelling of the brain to go down and everything to you know, get back to somewhat normal. It was a while before the brain chatter started to come back online. And when it started to come back online again, it was as though the slate had been washed clean or the disc had been totally emptied. I was an infant again. I didn't mm-hmm. have all of my language. So I was sitting in this silent mind for weeks upon weeks. And early on, you know, I was infantile. When you don't have your brain talking to you, you don't have any information about the external world. So people can talk to you and use language, but I didn't have any understanding of those words, so I couldn't understand it anyway. So it was very interesting to be, from my perspective, and to be in that silence. But then I had to learn language again from scratch. I had to learn words. I had to learn to speak again. I had to learn to read again. Reading was a terribly difficult experience for me. So I essentially was an infant. When I wiped out the language, I wiped out my knowledge of the external world. I didn't wipe out pictures. I still could eventually pull back on my anatomy that I had learned. I could still visualize the abdomen, but this was months later. It took for me to be able to capitalize on what memory was still left for me in the visual world.
Well, I asked you if this had changed your relationship to ultimate questions, and you said yes, 100%. So yeah. How has it impacted your sense of spirituality or God or life after death or any of those issues?
Well, as far as life after death, I have no idea what happens after death. But my experience of death, I have no fear of that. Because for me, I'm going to do what I did, essentially. I'm going to melt away my connection to the external world and move into a space of what I would describe as bliss and euphoria. And so that doesn't scare me. And, you know, it was a cognitive choice about a million times a day for me to recover. I didn't just recover. I recovered because I chose to recover, and I chose to endure the agony that I had to endure in order to force my mind by choosing to pay attention to something that I didn't understand and that brought me pain, in order to familiarize myself with that material more so that my brain could wrap itself around that. And that starts at having zero information and then being willing to learn and learn and learn. And learning is a difficult process for a brain that's been wounded.
Are you saying you could have chosen to just hang out in that state of bliss?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. In the very beginning, I had no intention of ever coming back. Once I was gone, I was gone. I was so far gone that there was no reason. I could not imagine enduring what I was going to have to endure in order to recover. So yes, it was a choice. For me, it was a choice. Now it was a choice moment by moment to say, in this moment, I'm willing to pay attention to you and try. But, you know, if a doctor came in and they really didn't have time for me and I was just another thing on their list and I could feel that energy, it's like, I'm not going to waste my energy trying to focus on you when you're not willing to focus your energy on me. So I responded positively to people who came into my world and brought me themselves 100%, looked me in the eye, touched me appropriately, connected with me, made me their focus for these moments. Then I could try to connect because that person was available. So absolutely, I believe that recovery, I was responsible for my recovery because I made the choice to try or to not try. And I think that, you know, the alternative, and I always teach this to my medical students, my alternative was to be out in bliss. And you want me to come back here and try to pay attention and learn something from you, you have to make yourself a very attractive object for me to want to focus on, because otherwise I'm out in the lap of the universe.
That's interesting. That bliss that you describe is sometimes people talk about the bliss of pure consciousness, and there are those who argue that that's really what the universe is made up of,
right,
is consciousness. And it sounds like that's the kind of experience that you had, and that experientially it moved you into this place where you no longer fear death, where you've had the sense that you will just dissolve into consciousness.
Yeah, that is what it felt like to me. As I would describe it, is I felt like a droplet of water that essentially got reabsorbed back into the ocean. And so the individuality of me as that droplet and any life or experience that it would have just got reabsorbed back into the bigger picture. And when I experienced the absence of knowing, the absence of thinking and relating to the external world in any way, when I was void of the boundaries and the definitions and the language and the right and wrong of it all, in absence of all that is an experience for me that was an all-knowingness. And so it was a cognitive choice for me to leave that space and to do what I needed to do in order to become distant enough away from that all-knowingness to relearn all the details. And it's two completely different perceptions of reality. And the point for me of that video was to help everybody recognize that we have both of these worlds inside of us all the time. And I'm receiving literally over 100 messages and offers a day since that video. It's been a month.
I'm not surprised.
It's been just a constant flow, and people who relate to the experience of being at one with all that is you know, they're just going, thank you for validating our experience to this group of left hemisphere world that we are dominated in, which has to define it and measure it in order to believe it. And my point is that we all have both. And I'm excited that people are talking about the brain. First of all, I'm absolutely thrilled to death that there are hundreds and thousands of people now who are talking about the brain. because I think that the brain needs to be talked about, and I think looking at our relationship with this organ and trying to figure out, you know, one group of people can't just say mysticism isn't real when you've got hundreds of thousands of people having an experience. Well, what is the experience, and what is the biology of the experience? And let's not say it isn't real and it doesn't count. They might not like the language that is used, so find your own language. But let's look at it using the tools of modern technology and modern science in order to have a better understanding about what's really going on.
Yes. Now, of course, it does raise the, I suppose, what you would call the reductionist question of, mm-hmm. is it all just the mechanics of the brain, or, you know, is there something else?
Well, who knows the answer to that, but you know, I mean, to me, even if we do reduce it to the brain, great, we all have one, and it has two halves. So if it is the brain, how can we really activate both hemispheres so that we can really take advantage of what we are as human beings on the planet? And I see the left hemisphere as being this beautiful, magnificent instrument that we can use in order to create the things and manifest what we do in the external world. And at the same time, we have this beautiful, magnificent right hemisphere that is connected, if you will, to the big picture. And don't you want a life that is a combination of both the big picture and the details? Because that way, then, you've got all of it. So even if it is just the organ, it doesn't matter. The organ is a biological entity created or not created. I don't know. I'm not even going on that trip somewhere. but it's still the organ. It doesn't say just because I can access this experience of bliss that in the absence of me, that's not what I will be or what is beyond me. You know, I did not die that
yes.
day. I've never made any comment that would indicate to anybody that I ever did or that I did have a post death experience. I did not. I had a hemorrhage.
Yeah.
I had a hemorrhage that shut down the neurocircuitry in part of my brain. That part of my brain became swollen. Those cells became non-functional. They had been dominating in my hemisphere, in my own personal brain. When they became non-functional, they lifted their inhibition from the other part of my brain that they had inhibited, and I became a different entity with a different character, a different personality, different interests, completely different perspective of the world. And then I made the choice to recover the circuitry and the functions of the hemisphere that had been dominating before. So you know, I can't speak beyond. All I can say is we have this incredible brain, and I'm really looking forward to how we explore how do we help people manifest being using both halves.
Sure.
At their choice.
Yes.
Because
To what extent are you able to access that experience now, to go back to that place, to that place of bliss and so on? Is that, are you able to get right back there, or to just sort of get back there?
Well, I made the decision when I was in the process of recovery. I was willing to recover enough of my left hemisphere as long as I didn't have to go back to being the person I was before.
Interesting.
So for me, it's a personality. Both of my hemispheres, my left hemisphere was, she was very smart, she was very determined, very motivated, very go, 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 very judgmental, very, very, very scientific in her way of being, very rational, very linear, very methodical, very all these wonderful tools. But there was a part of her that was also all about being right. Being right and being wrong, and being good and being bad, making that judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was in the process of recovering, you know, well, when I lost her, I became innocent. I became an infant. again. I had no knowledge of the world, and yet I was at perfect bliss. I was happy. I was euphoric. I would sit on my couch in my living room after the hemorrhage happened, waiting for surgery to happen, and my mother would just look at me, and I'd sit there with this grin on my face. There was a joyfulness. There was a joyful, childlike innocence about my life, and it was. I was so excited that I was alive. I was alive, and I could look out, and I could see color. I had eyes that could see color. It was like, oh my gosh, it was just so exciting, and just to be alive. And you know, there's this little piece of resistance saying, I don't want to go back to your world. I don't want to go back to the speed and the urgency and the meanness. There's a meanness about it. I didn't want to go there and do any of that again. So my agreement with myself was, I will recover. I will continue to dwell into what I need to in order to recover different circuits of my brain, as long as I didn't have to lose myself to that world again. So I didn't, and I just took my time. It took 8 years for me to walk my way back into a world that gave me a life that I could continue to be in my peace, in my joy, in my enthusiasm for all that is, and still communicate with the external world. Because in order for me to bring my message of how beautiful we are as living beings, and we have both of these hemispheres, in order for me to really communicate that again, I had to completely recover my left hemisphere.
Wow. It strikes me that this was a transformative experience for you. It was life transforming in terms, you know, not just in terms of a medical thing that happened to you, but in terms of a choice about your personality and who you wanted to be in the world. And I'm also, right. And I'm also struck by the role of letting go of judgment seems to have been important, that letting go of evaluating right or wrong, which, you know, plays such a strong role in Buddhist theory, that that it's our judgments that stand in the way of that state of bliss. Mm-hmm. So that's what's fascinating, is that through a different route, it seems to me, you've come to some places that, you know, that have been described and experienced elsewhere through other ways. I want to touch on something else relating to right-left hemisphere work, because there's been some research that was brought to my attention by one of my listeners, which has been done by Richard Davidson, who is, I believe, a psychologist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he's done some research with meditators, and his research seemed to show that that as people... Let's see, he says, by the end of the study, those who had meditated showed a pronounced shift in brain activity towards the left, quotes, happier, close quote, frontal cortex. The meditators also showed a healthier immune response to flu shots, suggesting that the training affected the body's health as well as the mind. So I'm struck that your experience kind of emphasizes that this was going on in the right hemisphere, and then there's this other rather surprising research that seems to locate some of this stuff in the left hemisphere. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, when I think meditation, I'm very excited because scientists are actually having individuals go into functional imaging machines and PET scanners to figure out, you know, what is actually shifting inside of the brain. And, you know, the beauty of the brain is that we all have one, and it's all very unique to who we are. So ultimately, variation is the rule, not the exception. And in order for anything to be defined as normal in anatomy, it only has to happen 70% of the time. 70% of the time. That's, you know, not that much more than half. So, you know, from an open-minded perspective as far as anatomy is concerned, we are all unique. And we are unique because we are influenced by our environments. And depending on language, for example, people who read language from left to right, their language centers will be structured and organized, and the circuitry that is interconnected will be different from people who read visual or vertical language or pictorial language. So those brains would be a little bit differently wired. At the same time, as I emphasize again, I'm not an expert on meditation, but I know that there are different types of meditation that would influence different circuits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly not saying that the only place where one can find bliss is in the right hemisphere, even though that was what I believe was my personal experience. The thing that these imaging studies generally have in common is that in order to experience that experience of joy, the language centers have to be silenced. So again, it's going to be what can we do through what type of mantra or prayer or meditation that is preoccupying the mind enough that the brain chatter that is taking care of all the routine details of our lives becomes quiet. And when that becomes quiet, then other areas in the brain have the capacity for us to shift outside of the me, I, detail into an experience of feeling a deeper inner peace. So I think it's wonderful that different experiments are showing different options. I think that it will help people who study those things better understand and put framework on what's actually going on in the brain.
Yes. Yes. You, in your book, and I should mention, and I will put a link to your website so that people who are interested can purchase your book or download a copy, and your book is titled A Stroke of Insight, and you've got some... You go into a lot of wonderful detail about all of this and about brain functioning as well in there, and it's all very readable and understandable. And one thing that you say in there is, if I had to choose one word to describe the feeling I feel at the core of my right mind, I would have to say joy. My right mind is thrilled to be alive.
Yeah, it's just that most innocent, open your eyes and say, Wow, I am life. I am alive. Anything else beyond that, that's all gravy. That's great. But just to be alive is this thrilling moment and this thrilling experience. And to know that is just such a wonderful blessing in my life. In all the details, details are wonderful too. But even in the absence of that, I am alive. And I think that one of the interesting things is that, when we look at individuals who have suffered some type of trauma, we automatically generally project our negative, how bad that is for them, how sad, how terrible, how awful. She's suffering a stroke. This is one of my things. So many people say, I suffered a stroke. And it's like, no, I did not suffer a stroke. I experienced a stroke. And for me, it was not a dreadful, awful experience. And that is a projection of someone else's fear of what it would be like for them. So a lot of the book is about recovery, and there are 50 recommendations for anybody who's experiencing any kind of brain trauma, whether it's due to war or due to stroke or due to a bicycle accident, any kind of recovery, but also recommendations for how to treat your own brain, your normal healthy brain, if that's what you think you have inside of your head. How to get that to do what you want it to do, how to create a relationship with your brain so that you can work with the cells in order to have them perform their functions better, and what you can give them in return for that, because they want sleep. They need good nutrition. They need you to move your body because that's how they flush out their waste. I think it's an overall very user-friendly book in order to take people on a wild ride, and a wild ride that a lot of people are curious about. What would it feel like to experience this? And then to have some insight into other people, other types of minds, minds of individuals with schizophrenia. What's it like inside of their mind for them? What's it like to be, to have a bipolar mind? What does that really feel like on the inside? And this might help give you a perception of looking at someone else with a more open perspective that, that can help you be more compassionate in your interaction with people who are different than you.
Yes, well, this raises the question of whether or not your experience helped you to understand your brother with schizophrenia any better.
It really did in many ways. In the beginning, it was kind of scary because I witnessed how people treat, not all people, of course, but how strangers in a store would look at me, and they could tell. I mean, it was obvious that I was a woman who wasn't normal. In the beginning, my head face droop, and I drooled on one side, and I was in slow motion walking, and but I had to get movement. So my mother would take me to the grocery store, and while all the shoppers are hustling and bustling around, here's this woman in very slow motion, just, you know, trying to get my movement in. So I definitely learned what it feels like to be on the inside of a mind that is not capable of functioning like a normal mind in our society. So I did have that experience. At the same time, it gave me an insight into really clearly understanding that I am neurocircuitry. I am neurocircuitry, and I can recognize you by your face because I have cells that perform that function, or I can track a moving object because I have cells that perform that function. And if those cells, for some reason, are wounded or no longer functioning, I can't perform that function. And so now I look at my brother's brain, and I look at other people diagnosed with schizophrenia, and I see the circuitry of what circuits are really working well. Why is it that my brother can experience hallucination and delusion, and what other circuits are not covering or inhibiting that? So it's given me a completely different perspective, both from the inside looking out as well as from the outside looking in at people who are different.
Yes. We've been hearing a lot about the plasticity of the brain recently, the ability to relearn for damaged areas to be compensated for by other areas of the brain. And your story, your experience is perhaps one of the most dramatic examples of that I've encountered, just hearing how you're able to speak so fluently and how you've kind of regained your professional persona, knowledge, etc., after having been in that state of droopy face and drooling and so on. It's pretty remarkable, I think.
I think I had an advantage in the process of recovery because I was totally, absolutely in awe and in love with the brain to begin with. To me, I chose neuroanatomy because I knew I would never be bored. That was my bottom line. I wanted a field that would always be stimulating. And we are babies in so many ways and really understanding what's going on in the brain. So I knew that throughout my lifetime, there would always be new things, new ideas, new things to think about, new ways of wrapping our minds around complex ideas. So to me, the first thing I think one of the reasons why I recovered so completely was I believed in the ability of this brain, this organ, to recover itself if I got out of its way. And to get out of its way meant, one, I would give it sleep. If it asked for sleep, if I was tired, I'd go to sleep. I would feed it well with good nutrition. I would take care of it. I would pay attention to it. I would exercise my body, and which science shows exercises the brain. But I think the biggest thing was I refused to see myself as less than I had been before, because I was different. I lost my left hemisphere. I lost my climb in the Harvard ladder. I lost my relationship with the external world. I lost all my relationships. I lost everything. It was all gone. I didn't even know what a mother was, much less who my mother was. I mean, I had no information about the external world, and yet I felt perfect and whole and beautiful just the way I was. So, you know, that's, so for me, I didn't become less than, I just became different. And then it was a matter of choices. Okay, well, I had taken care of my body, so it could go on for decades in this condition. Okay, well, you know, being in La La Land and sitting in the lap of the universe was a blissful experience, but okay, I'm going to have this when I'm dead, probably, and right now I am alive. I am alive, and what can I do now based on what I've learned about this experience of bliss? Boy, wouldn't this be an improvement in our society if everybody knew that they could come here and feel this? And so, as I mentioned in the video, that's really what motivated me to recover was the willingness to say, we have this incredible experience always available to us. It's always there. It's just like, I can't quote who it was, but someone brilliant said, the sky is always blue. The blue sky is always there. And I see that as the right hemisphere. And then you have the clouds might come in, but the blue sky is still always there. So the left hemisphere brain chatter might come in and distract you away from being able to see that beautiful blue sky, but it doesn't make the blue sky go away. So as soon as you get rid of those clouds, there's that beauty again. And for me, that is the existence of what I am as a living being. I have the blue sky all the time. I have this incredible left hemisphere language center that interacts with the external world, but I don't always have to focus on the clouds. I can flush those away and go back to the simple beauty of what I am as a living being.
Well, that's a great place for us to close. So, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. I really appreciate it.
I hope you found Dr. Jill's experience as fascinating as I do. I want to let you know that you can find the extraordinary video that first led me to her on the web at www.ted.com. That's www.ted.com. Go to that address and then do a search there for Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and you should find that video. It's a streaming video that's about 18 minutes long. It's well worth the experience, even after hearing her story here, I think. Also, let me mention that she has a website at www.drjilltaylor.com. That's spelled drjilltaylor.com, where you can download an Adobe Acrobat version of her book or order a hard copy, and also find out additional information about her and her upcoming presentations. I'll also put links to these two URLs in the show notes. Secondly, I'm hoping to put together another show in which I would jointly interview her and the noted mindfulness meditation teacher, Hsien-Tzin Yang. I mentioned her experience to Hsien-Tzin during my interview with him, which you'll find at wisecounselpodcast.com, and he said he'd love to be part of a three-way conversation. Hsien-Tzin is very interested in the integration of Eastern wisdom with Western science, so I'm in the process of exploring whether Dr. Jill would be open to this three-way dialogue and whether we can get our calendars to match up. Stay tuned for further developments.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Over 70% of you who voted in our last poll have said we should keep going with the periodic Shrink Wrap Radio live episodes. Consequently, my good friend Jerry Trumbull and I have scheduled our next Shrink Wrap Radio Live show for Sunday, April 20th at 10 a.m. Pacific. We'd love to have you call in or participate in the live chat at www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. By the way, be sure to check out my interview with noted mindfulness meditation teacher Shinzen Young on my other podcast series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. I think you'll find it most interesting. I'm going to be in Barcelona May 6th through the 14th, and I'd love to meet with any listeners in or around Barcelona, so please drop me an email if you're in that area. Our Frapper map has either topped out or it's broken. Does anyone out there know of a good substitute or a way that I can contact Google for information? I put a new poll question in the right-hand gutter area of our website. A couple of listeners have suggested that I should create a second feed for the archived shows. That would make it easier for you to get them. The poll question asks whether you would subscribe to such a feed. So go take the poll and let me know. The sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember, you can buy a domain name such as mybrainisinnirvana.com at a 10% discount by using the code SHRINK3 at checkout on GoDaddy.com.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Speaking of Dr. Cohen, Rick V. posted the following in our comments area in response to the first interview with Dr. Fern Cohen. Rick writes, "As far as I'm concerned, this was by far the most interesting of shows to date. I've had a few people who've told me that I should be a psychodynamic therapist, an observation I've wondered about but now have a clearer understanding of since listening to this outstanding interview and presentation of what analysis is all about. There are a couple of problems, though. One is that the show ended just as it was really getting down to the nitty-gritty. Two, that one more podcast isn't going to be enough. In broadcasting, these are two great problems to have. I will be waiting eagerly for the next session with Dr. Cohen and hoping that there might be an interview 3, 4, 5. I have a feeling that Dr. Dave, that your show is doing a lot of good. I also have a name for your fans, Dave Votees." Lots of laughs. Thanks for that, Rick, and I hope that you, in fact, did enjoy the second interview with Dr. Cohen, which is now up. And let me remind the rest of you that your comments are invited on our website. Paul, our philosopher and reggae singer in Canada, writes, "The show sounds great. I really enjoyed the one on happiness you did recently. It gave me a fresh outlook on how to think of happiness that is pleasantly different from the perhaps more cynical view of happiness that I've been studying and writing on for a while now, namely Giacomo Leopardi's notion that happiness is impossible as we mostly want more than we have in virtue of self-love. It was a pleasure to hear my reggae. Thank you. I'm off to college. Have a great day, Paul." Next, we hear from Derek, who I believe is also in Canada. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a longtime listener to Shrink Wrap and lately to Wise Counsel and have emailed you before, but not from this address, which is now my main one. By the way, thanks immensely for following up on my suggestions to interview Dr. Edward Tick and another Shrink Wrap Radio interviewee whose name escapes me momentarily." Well, Derek, the one that's escaping you is Dr. Robert Altemeyer, who I interviewed on the authoritarian personality, and both of those recommendations from you were wonderful. Back to Derek's letter, he writes, "Anyway, I just heard your Wise Counsel interview with Shinzen Young on mindfulness, but there's not a place yet to leave comments about that interview on the wisecounselmentalhealth.net site. So I'm writing directly to congratulate you on another absolutely essential and vitally relevant interview." Thank you. The timing for me was a particularly nice bit of synchronicity. a phenomenon which seems to cluster around your podcast to a larger than normal degree, if the notion of a normal degree of synchronicity has any actual meaning. But I digress. I had just listened to another Wise Counsel podcast that really moved me, namely the one with Dr. Marcia Linehan on dialectical behavior therapy. The paradox of change and acceptance has always struck me as a fundamental puzzle of all forms of psychotherapy, and her notion of taking that paradox and turning it into the dialectical engine at the heart of the dialectical behavior therapy approach really lit up my synapses and obviously has for many others. That interview, you may recall, also included an extended discussion of mindfulness, and I just finished listening to it and was reflecting upon its implications when the Shinzen Young interview devoted to mindfulness popped up in the Wise Counsel feed in iTunes. I smiled in quietly awe-filled acknowledgement of the perfect cosmic timing. Keep up the great work. If you can indeed engineer an encounter between Shinzen Young and the scientist struck with hematoma-induced Satori, you'll have at least one breathlessly eager listener, Derek. And Derek, as you heard me listen earlier in the show, that is still my ambition to put that together. Thanks so much for your email and your wonderful comments there. And I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember to send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages using the My Chingo button on our website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. So let me hear from you. And thanks again to Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor for sharing her incredible stroke experience. Next week's guest will be Toronto Shrink Wrap Radio listener, author, and therapist, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, speaking about ego state therapy. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.